Okay, it looks like our panelists are about ready. They're doing final adjustments, so I'm going to go ahead and kick off our session today. My name is Amy Philbrook. My pronouns are she and hers, and I lead diversity and inclusion at Fidelity Investments. We are so excited to be corporate sponsors and supporters of the Massachusetts Conference for Women, because this is a space where we all come together in order to make gender equity go from aspiration to reality. Now, at Fidelity, we know that true gender equity cannot come without economic equality as well. And that is why it is our mission at Fidelity to make sure that every woman has the knowledge and the confidence to ensure that her money works as hard as she does. The session this morning is entrepreneurship. Pioneer passion, innovation, and vision. In a few moments, you're going to meet some very courageous and powerful women, and they have lessons to share with anyone in this room who is looking to increase and unleash their power and their productivity. I'm excited to say that our moderator for this event is the fabulous Alicia Reese. She is a Woman of Power Award winner. We're all Women of Power. She is a Woman of Power Award winner. She is the Chief Brand Strategist for 360 Gateway Brands. And she is the author of an exciting book with the very intriguing title, Eating Elephants. Alicia, the stage is yours.
All right. So now, I'm not a teacher, but I have a 10-year-old, so we're going to have to get some good energy in here. You guys ready? Yep. Awesome. How are you this morning? Good. Ooh, I love that. I love it. Okay, so we're going to get started. Entrepreneurship is one of my favorite topics, primarily because it is how I actually got started before I became an entrepreneur. So I look good now, but that's not how it started. For me, when I was born, there were rats crawling around my head. We lived in a shack at the time, and my mother decided that she was not going to allow where we began to dictate or determine where we would go. She worked three jobs to get us out of that shack and moved us to MLK Boulevard. We lived in a house off of MLK. Now, whether it's by design or not, that is to be debated, but everyone knows anytime you live off of Martin Luther King Jr. Way, it is in every city in the United States, the ghetto. Like it or love it, it is what it is. So I grew up in a really dichotomous situation in that during the day, because my mother bartered cleaning services for a private school, we were private school educated, but at night we lived next door to the neighborhood drug dealer. So anytime there were raids, he would throw his drug paraphernalia in our yard. So I didn't grow up with any contacts, no playbooks, nobody to show me how this should go. It was pure tenacity and my decision that where I'm born does not get to decide where I'll be. Fast forward, I decide that I am going to get married. A few months before my marriage, I was 17 weeks pregnant, and my amazing ex-husband decided that he was going to cheat. And I caught him. In doing so, he slammed me into the ground while 17 weeks pregnant, and I lost that child 3 days later. I would choose abusive men the way children choose candy because I felt, because of where I had grown up, that I wasn't worth it, I wasn't worthy, and I had no inherent value. Pretty terrible way to get started, right? Not so fun. I did really, really well in education because I understood, like Nelson Mandela said, the way to get out is to get an education. So I did really, really well in school. I had started working for a startup company under the Washington Post, and I went to my COO one day and I said, "Hey, we have a big problem." And he looked at me strange because, you know, I'm kind of short, and he's a pretty tall guy, and he looked at me kind of strange, and he's like, "Well, what's the problem?" And I tell him, "Well, we can't come in on time or on budget because our product team, they kind of, you know, they don't suck, but the way they produce, the way in which they produce kind of sucks." I'm like, "So you need someone to be a project manager for them." And I had figured out what a project manager was because I started Googling what industries make a lot of money that I could not only make some really great money, because although I was married, I was a married single parent, but what industries make a lot of money that I can take care of my child, and it would allow me the opportunity to learn something new every day. So I went to my boss and I'm like, you need a project manager, and I'm willing to be your project manager. And he goes, well, are you trained in that? No, but that's not the point. I am willing to be your project manager. And so he goes, okay, well, what does that look like? I said, well, if you bring in one of the top project managers in the nation to train me and then pay for my certification as a scrum master, I will give you 3 years. So he looked it over. I told him this is what it will look like in terms of costs. We have a partnership with LinkedIn right now that we're going to lose if we don't produce this product that we said we'll have by this date. That was about a year out. Forethought. Whenever you're looking to become go into a position where you're now an entrepreneur, you are a leader in your organization, you've got to have some forethought. Think like you are the CEO of whatever industry, brand, or department that you're in. So he looked at the numbers and he said, you know what? This makes sense. The cost and the time frame that it'll take you to learn this information with what we will lose if we don't figure out how we can get this project to come in at least on time, because we're way past the budget. We're going to lose at this. So he agreed. And within 1 year, a little less than 1 year, I was trained and I was leading that team. We not only produced the first massive open online courseware for Kaplan University in partnership with LinkedIn, but then we were able to go on to do so many other things before I left there. So I did that because I did 5 things. And you're going to want to write these down. Some of them are tweetable. Just at me so I know it's real. The first one is be clear. Be very, very clear on your desired career role, your path, and even your income, because that matters. When you have clarity of thought, you're able to actually get to wherever it is that you desire to go. You can't get to any destination if you have not yet put it in your GPS. Whether you're driving a Honda or a Bentley, it doesn't work unless you actually have put a destination in. So be very, very clear. Number 2, know your role. Inside and outside of the company, your entire job is to identify where your areas of opportunity are and then also where you shine brightest. Because if you can pinpoint where those areas of opportunity are or where your areas of genius are, then you can become what I like to call a forever student. I am always, always, always learning something about my industry. If you can do the same, then you now become an asset in a world full of liabilities. And that is your entire goal with everything that you're doing in order to win at the entrepreneurship game, because it really is all a game. You have got to become an asset. And to do that, know your role inside and outside of your company. And then the third one is to schedule meetings with your upper management. Too many times, especially women, we won't schedule meetings with those who have the power to put us in position. We won't go and have coffee. We won't take them our ideas. We don't do any of that. And then we expect to be hired or promoted or put into places of advancement. And that's just not how it works. You can have the cure for cancer, but if nobody knows, people will continue to die. The same thing with your gifts, tools, and talents. You have got to schedule meetings with those who can become mentors and or sponsors for you. And we will definitely get into what those two are in depth and the differences in them later in our discussion. But you have got to schedule meetings with them, because once they know what you're good at, then they can position you like players on, like, you know, positions on a chessboard to put you in places that will actually help them look good too. So schedule meetings, and not just a, hey, how you doing type of coffee. This meeting needs to be, so I noticed we are doing X, Y, and Z. Here are ways in which I can assist you to make sure that we come to market or we hit our KPIs or meet our goals. That is what that meeting is for. You can have coffee with your girlfriends or your boyfriends. This one is for business, okay? The fourth one, and we've only got 5, is you want to make sure that you're opting in. Opt in for those high visibility projects. Opt in to lead those employer resource groups. Opt in. Raise your hand to say, yeah, I think I have some skill set here. I want to take on this project. I'd like to do this. I'd like to partner with you or collaborate you to do this. Because what it does is it introduces you to different departments in your particular company. And so now you can leverage those relationships, because life truly is a relationship game. And in order to win at it, you've got to learn how to build those mutually beneficial relationships. And you do so by opting in. And then now the last one is to barter. Don't be afraid to barter and ask for what you want. The worst they can do is say yes. I know most times you'll hear the worst they can do is say no, but we don't want that kind of negative energy in our universe. So the worst they can do is say yes. Be willing to barter. You are of value. Every single person in here, just raise your hand real quick for me before we get into our moderation. Raise your hand real quick. Just every single person, raise your hand. Every person who raised their hand, you have value. There is something of value that you have. What you have got to do in order to win at this entrepreneurship game is just take the value that you have and leverage that value in order to win inside of your organizations. And that's it. All right. So now we are going to let our amazing MC, are you coming back up or should I go ahead and, oh yeah, listen. And now these women are amazing. So we are going to have our illustrious panel members come right on up, ladies. Hello.
Hi.
Thank you.
Yep.
Awesome, awesome. So now each of you are just goals on just a whole nother level, especially when I was reading through your bios. I got super excited to be able to have this conversation today because the insight that you guys have and that you can provide will just be, I know it's going to be like game changing for us. So we're going to hop right on in, okay? So now I would like to, if each of you can take just a quick 30 seconds to tell us who you are, and then maybe either what you're most proud of or why you're here today. Go ahead. Courtney.
Oh, sure.
I'm going to nominate you.
Great. So hi, everyone. My name is Courtney Laurie. I lead our brand and integrated marketing team at Wayfair, and that covers a few different areas. Mass brand marketing channels like TV, video, direct mail and catalog, integrated marketing such as consumer PR, creative strategy and partnerships, and finally physical retail. The one thing that I'll say is I joined the company 10 years ago, and there were roughly, I think, 400 people there when I joined. And I was second in place for a role and didn't get it. And through 17 emails over the course of 3 weeks, I begged and begged to get this role, and finally they let me into Wayfair. So I'm very excited. I think that speaks to persistency. My team now is the size roughly of 80 people, and I'm really excited to talk about this topic today because it really resonates with me for a multitude of reasons.
Yes, love it. Go ahead.
My name is Renata Black. I'm the co-founder of EBI, which stands for Empowered by You. We're an online subscription underwear business that was co-founded by myself and Sofia Vergara. The reason why Sofia and I came together was really to enable women to have an impact with the one decision you make every morning, which is the underwear that you wear. We give 10% of our proceeds to help women start their own businesses to come out of poverty. It was important for us to really ask ourselves what the best use of our life is. And for us, it was creating killer, the most best-in-class product, and also letting women have an impact. I'm super proud of all the women that are here today because I heard that this event sold out in 20 minutes, and that's 13,000 women. When I started Women's Empowerment, it was 2006, and I couldn't get a woman on my board. So I'm just really proud of this event and being here, so thank you.
Absolutely.
What an opening, first of all. I was just so energized listening to that, so thank you.
Absolutely.
My name is Sarah LaFleur. I'm the founder and CEO of MM LaFleur. We are a clothing company for working women. I think the stat that I like to share with my customers is that, similar to what you were just talking about with Evie, but women on average spend 15 more days a year getting ready for work versus men. 15 days is just a lot of time, and if you think about, I mean, initially when I heard the stat, I was like, that's not possible, and you know, now I watch my husband literally set his alarm for 15 minutes before he's about to head out the door, and you just understand how these the time multiplies. And so I think a lot of what we're trying to do, I started it with my co-founder, Miyako. She used to be the head designer at Zac Posen, comes from this really illustrious fashion background. I am not the designer, but I think it was the two of us coming together to say, okay, what can we design that's actually beautiful and really practical for working women? So we do a lot of machine washable, wrinkle resistant pieces using the finest fabrics from Italy, Germany, and Japan. I think what am I proud of? I started MM at a time in my life where I had really lost all professional confidence. I had taken a job at a private equity firm, which was, I thought, my dream firm for 3 years. I finally got the job, and I think first weekend I knew it wasn't the place for me. Actually, there was one other female investment professional who was a managing director, and at my welcome lunch, she came to me and said, "This is not a good place for women." And it was a pretty. That was my welcome lunch. And
Yes,
and then 4 months later, I put in my 2 weeks' notice and left, and it was, kind of career suicide or so I thought, and I was worried that nobody else would hire me again because I had just perpetually destroyed my resume, and that led to me thinking, okay, I better start my own company because I got to pay the bills somehow. So I tutored for 2.5 years while working on MM, and here I am. It's been a wild ride. We've got about 250 employees now, 8 stores around the country. Most of our sales are still online, but the entrepreneurship topic is very resonates with me deeply because I was also a corporate employee, and I think there are actually a lot of ways to be innovative in the place that you are. So I'm looking forward to talking about that today.
Yes, I love that. Can we give them a hand clap just one more time? So now, Courtney, we're going to start with you,
right?
Simply because we're closest, so I'm feeling that energy there. So now, you were at Wayfair for over 10 years, right? Now, you worked in the category of management, but now, of course, you lead the brand integrated marketing. So now, what advice do you have for other people who see an opportunity to create like a new team that doesn't yet exist in their company? Like, what worked well for you? Because I know you sent about 17 emails to get into Wayfair. So how did that work well? Like, what did you learn?
I'll set a little context first. When I look back at my career at Wayfair, roughly half of my team today is in place because I proactively recommended starting a new platform or a new channel to upper management. I didn't really wait for the leadership team to come to me and say, "Hey, you need to do this," or "Can you start this program on behalf of Wayfair?" And so with that context in mind, I have a couple of pieces of advice for folks in the room that are looking to start a new team, one of which is, don't be a silent sufferer. I think we are all, and I think you mentioned this in the intro as well, we are all, the mic's not on. Yeah.
Hey, Mike.
Hello?
Awesome.
Nice.
You're back.
So don't be a silent sufferer. And I think we're all guilty in this room probably at one point or another turning to our colleague or our manager and saying, "Wouldn't it be an awesome idea if we did X?" Or, "Haven't we thought about Y?" Like, get that idea out there. And it takes a lot of courage to do this. But what I've found successful is much like studying for a college exam. Like, if you put the effort into it and you anticipate the questions that they're going to ask, you're really setting yourself up for success in the moment that you actually have that opportunity to explain your idea to your manager or your leader. So that would be one. I think the other piece of advice is be data-driven. It's really hard to go wrong when you're leveraging data to share with your leadership team or your manager an idea and really showcasing the opportunity size that idea has or the impact that it could drive for the business or the customer. So definitely be data-driven. And then lastly, I think it's really important to be okay to fail. Like, when I look back on all of the various ideas I've suggested, more than half of them have been total bombs. But I learned something from it, and I celebrate those failures with my team. We have a roast and toast at the end of every year to celebrate the failures, and it's actually one of my favorite events because I think it encourages that entrepreneurial spirit within our team.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I always say, failure is merely greatness in its infancy. You're not failing. You're just figuring out all the ways that don't work. So just, next item on the agenda. Mm-hmm. So now, Renata, you traveled. Now, my favorite thing in the world is to get on a plane and travel somewhere. So you traveled to 12 different countries to volunteer. Now, this part of your journey led you to establishing the Stephen Barr Foundation. But now, during those travels and your 2 years living in India, can you share what you learned from a lot of the women that you met, specifically around like creativity, passion, and vision?
Sure. So, one of the things that really led me to take this trip was both of my parents died when I was very young, and I was adopted. brought to the States. Originally, I'm from Colombia. And when I didn't get my dream job, which was working for MTV, obviously my life was shattered, and I just cried for 2 weeks in my bed, and I heard there was a ticket around the world. And I took a trip around the world and volunteered in different countries. And as I was traveling, it was the tsunami, and I was like, well, I'll go volunteer there. And what happened was really just changed my life forever was that there were these really powerful women, and there was so much aid coming in, and these really powerful women were becoming beggars. And I'm like, oh, that's just not what I learned. Like, I thought aid should be helping them. It really hurt me. I was like, God, it shouldn't be that way. And I found microfinance, and there was a gentleman named Muhammad Yunus who was doing microfinance in Bangladesh. So I went, studied under Muhammad Yunus, learned microfinance, found this woman who originally had come up to me while I was cleaning the villages and said to me, hey, I don't want your money, but can you just teach me how to make it? And I was like, first of all, I'm so broke. Like, I don't know how to make any money. But, you know, it really stuck with me because I'm like, these women want to be self-sufficient. Yeah. Came back, found this woman, and I'm like, I can teach you now because I had learned microfinance. And she was like, great, I have some friends. Brought 800 of her friends the next day, and they all wanted to learn.
Now, it's a good friend.
Yeah, so what was really interesting along this point was that I went to my organization. I'm like, there's this thing called microfinance, and like we can raise money, and we can give them like these loans, and they'll then, you know, repay the loans, and they can grow their businesses, and they just want a hand up. They don't want a hand out. And he's like, great, you do it. And I was like, me? Like, you want me to do this? Like, I don't know how to do this. But I just did it. And to your point, like, you don't know what you're capable of if you don't try, even if you're going to fail. Like, you find a way. And I did. And I lived there for 2 years. And I actually, that group of 800 women ended up coming out of poverty. And it really set my trajectory to who I am today, because what I presenced was that the reality and how fortunate I am to be adopted and live in the States, like all of us, is that 98% of the world lives on $2 a day. So if you're a nurse or a school teacher in the U.S., you're part of the highest pay salary in the world. Mm-hmm. Now think about everyone in this room, the power that we have, and we have to ask ourselves, what is the best use of our life? And so I think that, you know, being at a conference like this, being able to share, like, take these skills, run with it, fail, and try. But that, to me, this transformative experience has allowed me to do what I do and obviously partner with, like, people like Sofia Vergara who share a similar vision.
Yeah. And I love what you said, too, about the fact that you didn't know it. She asked you a question, piqued your interest, and then you decided, okay, well, I don't know this, but let me go learn it. Same thing when you are looking to rise, rise in the ranks, is you don't have to know it in order to say, okay, this is what it's going to be. I knew nothing about project management. You knew nothing about micro loans or micro funding.
Nothing.
And you went and sat for 2 years to learn and then came back. I love, love, love that.
Thank you.
So now, Sarah, you've held, you know, you held a number of corporate positions, and also you were a consultant at Bain, and so you transitioned from an entrepreneur to an entrepreneur. Now, there are so many lessons that can be learned there, of course, but now, since you did transition, what would you recommend, or how would you recommend, like, applying that entrepreneurial, startup-type energy, value, and mindset to, like, working inside of, like, a larger corporation?
I've been thinking about this a lot, and I just wanted, I'm like testing this idea, so please be gentle with me.
Yes.
I was talking with my college roommates last night, and we called it the yoga teacher crisis, which I don't know how many of you are, you know, maybe in your, call it late 20s to mid 30s, but or later. I think in my early 20s, like all I could think about was my career. That was like the most important thing in my life, and it defined who I was, and I faced a lot of career crises because it was so tied to my identity. And I think this was true of a lot of my girlfriends as well coming out of college. You know, we were going to be the generation that had it all. And then suddenly you hit your 30s. I don't have kids yet, but a lot of my college roommates do. And there comes this place where you're exhausted, and you have to make some real trade-offs, I think, about whether you keep climbing the ladder or whether you cruise for a bit. Mm-hmm. And then I think for a lot of these women who are like, wait, I thought I was going to have it all, I thought I was going to get to the top, there comes this moment where I was like, well, okay, like, maybe I should just quit it all, leave it all, and go become a yoga teacher. nothing against yoga teachers, but, you know, like, my version of this fantasy is there's this woman, Amanda Brooks, who, like, left New York City and now has moved to the Cotswolds in England, and, you know, she has sheep roaming her farm. And I look at that, and I was like, oh, like, maybe I should just leave it all because I'm so exhausted and go move to the Cotswolds and relax a little bit because I think that would be, I need that for my soul. Mm. And so it becomes one or the other. Mm-hmm. And I just noticed, like, my male friends are not doing this. They're not. They don't have these escapist fantasies about becoming a yoga teacher and moving to the Cotswolds. And I was like, why is that? I think, I mean, one is societal. Like, I don't think many men are given the option to opt out. And I think also the truth is so much of the childbearing or family caring responsibilities societally fall on women. And so I'm trying to figure out, like, what is the middle ground? Like, is there a way to continue to opt in without feeling like you're having to burn yourself at both ends or quit and go become a yoga teacher. And so I think this entrepreneurship is actually, it's a wonderful way to think about that opportunity. I will say, like, entrepreneurship is not for somebody who is... who has a lot of other responsibilities, because it is exhausting and it is all in, and you can never leave it. Financially too, it's a lot of risk to take. And so when I started my business, you know, I was 27, I had no mortgage. I could make ends meet by, like, tutoring. But I think that's just not the reality if you have children you need to take care of or family you need to take care of. So, being entrepreneurial, that gives you a stable paycheck, but a way to still be excited and invigorated about the work that you do, to create exciting opportunity for yourself, but not feel like you're risking everything. So I'm really a proponent for that idea.
I love that. And it's so true. I tell my girlfriends all the time, I'm like, this entrepreneurship journey is like going into the wilderness without any tools and having
totally.
To cook food for yourself.
Yeah.
It can be a little traumatic, actually. But as an entrepreneur, you really are empowered to not only have that consistency, like you said, but then to also have that ability to create and use that creativity to generate millions and sometimes billions of dollars for the companies that you work for and with. So now, when did you know? Because you are just, I mean, entrepreneurship goals, because of how high you've climbed up the ranks at Wayfair from where you started. So when did you know that it was time to kind of make that evolution and evolve at Wayfair? And then did you have any, like, advocates or sponsors along the way who helped you do so?
Yeah, sure. So I'll break it out in two parts. My first 3 years at Wayfair, I was in a department called category management, and I absolutely loved it. But for a year and a half towards the end, I started feeling like I was getting a little bit stagnant, like I wasn't learning anymore, and I could almost put one eye closed and just keep, you know, chugging along. And it was interesting because at the end of the year, either, you know, you have performance reviews or it's just new year, new you. You start reflecting on, you know, what have I accomplished this year and what do I want to accomplish next year? And 2 years in a row, I was reflecting back on the results that I drove, and they looked very similar. And so that kind of gave me an indication, you know, mid-20s, that I wanted to try something entirely different. But I absolutely loved Wayfair. So I just raised my hand and looked around and asked to move from category management to marketing. And then since then, this is part two, I haven't left the marketing department in 7 years because, you know, when I'm having bandwidth or have an opportunity to take on more, I'm raising my hand and providing insight into what I think that we can do. So I really want to harp on that last point. I think a lot of people think they need to find an entirely new role to scratch a new itch. And oftentimes you can build your own kingdom within your given role today, as long as you're communicating the opportunity that's at hand and really just being an open communicator with your manager. So I highly encourage, look at the role that you have today. If you love it, keep trying to build upon it, particularly for people in, like, small and mid-sized companies. You can really set your runway.
Oh, yeah. Very true. Because there's a little more wiggle room. They're a little more agile.
Yes, exactly.
So then now, coming from not having any idea about microfunding, microloans, going to study, staying on top of your game was key, right? It was super key. It was necessary in order for you to grow, to get from where you started to now where you are now. So how do you not only keep yourself on top of your game, but then now what advice do you have in our audience for our women today who also need to, okay, how do I leverage, how do I stay on top so that I can, you know, move higher?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to write off your point, a couple things, right? I feel like we've really glamorized entrepreneurship and made it like this, like the most unbelievable thing. It is very hard.
Brutal.
Like it's basically, it is flying a plane and building it at the same time and finding people that really want to do that with you. Yeah. And it's, I would say to you that being able to extend the reach and impact of an existing organization could definitely be the best use of your life, because there's no need in starting new startup costs. There's a lot of amazing companies out there. And in order to do that and do that really successfully, for me, it's come down to mindset, right? I'm very protective over the thoughts that I have in my mind, because if you ever listen to this crazy monkey in your head, and you ever just say everything you talk about, you sound like a crazy person, and you have to be very mindful of the thoughts that you listen to, because that really dictates your actions. And so I just kind of sometimes channel like a superwoman, and I'm like, shh, I'm not going to let you in, I'm not letting you in. And I presence this, and with my team, it's like, when you're an entrepreneur, you're having no for breakfast, no for lunch, no for dinner. And you got to wake up the next day with that much more excitement and like Guns N' Roses, Sell the Dream Again and sing Paradise City with that same amount of enthusiasm. And you have to not be a victim of the past and be a vision of the future and be unwavering in that. And that is hard, but it's a muscle that you build in your brain. Mm-hmm. And so that to me has been what has really kept me on my game. And it's not like I know this. I have to like prepare myself every single morning to remind myself to do that. So that really is what it comes down to. I would say that mindset is really everything, because as an entrepreneur, it's not just working on the business. You're working in the business, and then you're working on the business. You're zooming in, and you're zooming out. And it's a really strong skill to do that. And as an entrepreneur, if you can anticipate your boss's needs or your team members' needs, like, you become that much more valuable, right? So it's constantly, as an entrepreneur, an intrapreneur, like, how can you focus in your business, getting your job done, but also take a step back and look at it holistically, which is what you did, right, and what you've done. Obviously, she's built like the most amazing company, which I love. It's not an easy skill set to have. So also try to practice that. But at the end of the day, I think it's if we can get outside of our own way, it's when we will be the most powerful.
I love that. I love that. And what you did is what I started to do. So mindset truly is everything. If you think you can, you can. If you think you can't, you can't. So as you're working in your positions and in your corporations, what I always tell folks to do is figure out what makes you truly happy. Not because you're in a position, not because you've gotten a certain, you know, title, but figure out what that is, because you're going to want to, in order to be your most powerful, authentic self, you need to also be whole. And that's something that a lot of people kind of forget, especially when they are climbing the corporate ladder, is you forget that wholeness has nothing to do with your title or the responsibilities that you have. It has everything to do with who you are as a person. So whether that's going to yoga or whether it is listening to, you know, How to Be a No-Limit Person by Dr. Wayne Dyer, whatever it is, and you probably should, it's How to Be a No-Limit Person. It's not my book, so it's not a shameless plug. But, you know, Sarah Blakely, she told me that that's what she listened to from the time she was a teenager, and she has a billion-dollar company now, so it might be good advice. Take that. Run with it. But I listened to it on Audible, especially when things get really, really hard, when I was working in corporate America, and also now as an entrepreneur now. You see, you get them confused a little bit. But listen to that and listen to it over and over and over again, because your mind is the most powerful tool that you have. Mm-hmm. And it controls everything. Mm-hmm. Everything. So now, Sarah, yes. When you were getting MM LaFleur off the ground, I know you said you worked for 2.5 years as a tutor, which, persistence. I have a 10-year-old and there is no way I can tutor her for anything. I have to hire out for that one. But now, what was the hardest part of getting MM off the ground? And then if you had to do it all over again, what would you do differently that we can also apply in our corporate positions?
Oh, gosh. you'll probably also relate to this, but I feel like entrepreneurship is like you make 10 mistakes every day.
Yes.
Continuously, and you just to learn to not even register them as mistakes because they're so continuous. I will say, I'm sorry, the first question was what lessons did I learn? Is that right?
what was the hardest part about getting
I think the hardest part was actually managing my own psychology. I mean, you mm-hmm. talked to this as well, but I just want to like level set where I was coming from. Like, I left this job and you know this private equity job that I had, and I had no paycheck coming in, and then my health insurance stopped coming in, and I was like, wait a minute, like I don't have health insurance. So I forced my then boyfriend, now husband, to like go and become domestic partners with me, so I could get on his health insurance plan.
Smart.
This was like before Obamacare, and then I was like, wow, like my cash flow is just out. There's nothing coming in, like. It's a feeling that I was really lucky to grow up with parents who always just kind of coddled me, and I didn't realize how financially insecure I was at that point. And so I started tutoring the SATs, which is like the thing I was still best at when I was 27, which is a sad thing to say about your life. But in New York City, parents pay a lot for SAT tutoring, so that's what I was doing. And I think it kind of felt like a fall from grace, if you will. Not that like my resume was anything special, but like I graduated from college, I had a job. Like I was like I was building this resume. I thought I had a career, and then suddenly it just all went to nothing. And I was an SAT tutor, and so I felt like I had nothing to show for myself. And to I think actually just keep putting one foot in front of the other. And a lot of my girlfriends were saying like even my close friends were like, oh, Sarah's like starting a dress company, kind of like head patty, and to kind of say like, yeah, I'm gonna start like the biggest women's workwear brand, to actually just kind of tell myself that every day. I think that was the hardest part, like managing your own psychology. I mean, I don't make any secret about this. I see a shrink every week. She's been with me for 8 years now at this point. Yeah. She's an incredibly essential part of my life. I run every morning, not because I'm a fitness buff, but because I need it for my mental sanity. I think like managing yourself, if you can't manage your own mind, like everything else kind of falls to the wayside. So I definitely give that as my number one recommendation. I think the mistake I made was not knowing that. Mm-hmm. I kept saying like, I just have to push through it, work as hard as I possibly can. Like not like forget all meals. No, it's like no. You got to eat 3 meals a day. You got to run. You got to take care of yourself. So that would be the advice that I would part. Put yourself first.
Absolutely, because again, like I said before, you can't be your best self if you're not your best self.
Yes. Yeah.
So for all three of you, because you did work in corporate, and now you left because the environment was just not good or okay. But as we wrap this up, because I want to make sure we get to these questions that I know you guys are just burning desire to ask. When it comes to finding a company culture that works for you and finding bosses who are, like you said, who highlight and cherish and get excited about the things that didn't work because it leads you to what does, every boss isn't like that. Let's just mm-hmm. be honest. We're going to be honest in the room today. So how would each of you suggest, and from your perspectives, how can you find either companies or bosses or leaders that help or encourage like a culture of entrepreneurship? And then what does it look like? So how can you find them? And then what does it look like? Maybe what are some identifiers? And we can start with you.
I would say, I'll start with the second part of the question, which is, I think gravitating towards organizations that allow you to test and learn, I think is a really, really important quality to look for. They always ask you at the end of an interview, what questions do you have? I think that's a really good one to ask. And then, innovation, I think people can sometimes get confused on what innovation actually means. It's really the idea plus the action, and having that potential manager be able to describe, recent innovations, both the idea and then the action that individual or that team had, I think gives you a really good sense of the culture of being, entrepreneurialism. And then the first part of the question was, how do you find people?
Yeah. So like, how do you identify like, okay, this is a company or this is a leader or a manager who is okay with me being an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I think part of it is doing your own research in the moment in those interviews. But I think another thing that's been helpful for me within the walls of Wayfair has been asking around to others, how does that manager tend to run their team, or what is a really great win that they've had or failure that they've had, and so doing your homework in that way and leveraging mentors to help guide you in certain directions if you're looking outside of your company as well. I've never sort of looked to mentors to give me the instruction manual on where to go, but I certainly use them for validation or advice to help me build what my next thing might be.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
I think with this whole notion of constantly really feeling comfortable with feeling uncomfortable, which is just odd, but you have to always be uncomfortable if you're going to be outside of your own comfort zone, if that makes any sense, right? And that means trying to reach out to people that you would normally not reach out to. So just, can you have a coffee? Do you have 15 minutes? Like, I once read an article from this writer called Deepak Chopra. I don't know if you guys know who he is.
It's a little bit.
And I wrote this article about him, and they said, what are you doing now? And he said, I'm supporting innovative solutions for poverty alleviation. And I'm like, well, I'm empowering women with underwear, so that's really innovative. And so I wrote him a letter like a kid with a dream, and he and I became great friends, and he wrote a chapter about me in one of his books. And it was like, wow. Just because I decided to, well, he was like one of 1,000 people. I was just constantly getting no's and emailing. But it's just like being so resilient and to the no's that you'll finally get a yes. And, I think that my team themselves, we're constantly failing forward. And, we sometimes have too many aspirational goals. And if you want to meet my team, we have an amazing booth for you guys to meet us. And we're giving a free box to all the women today.
Oh,
so
yeah,
definitely
yeah.
Pass by. But I think that they would say to you that we are always pushing ourselves out of our limit, what we think is our limits, because that's how we know what we're capable of. And I always come back to you to saying that. So that would be it.
I think it's interesting. There's like a theme of persistency here, yeah, like amongst all of us, which is exciting.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say, look for the boss who is getting promoted a lot, who is probably overwhelmed. So the person who just got promoted a lot is probably taking on new responsibility and is probably overwhelmed and is probably not sure how to manage it all. And if you go up to her and say, like, hey, I can help you out. I know you're overwhelmed and I want to be your go-to person. I want to be your right hand. There's going to be a project flowing your way. So
yes.
just look
That's
for that person and ride their tailcoat.
I hope you wrote that down.
All right, are we ready
to
go to question and answer?
Oh, yes, we are ready.
Okay. We have microphones in the aisles, and we know that you have questions because you are all humbled and inspired by the heart and the grit and the brains of the women on this stage. So I'm going to ask, if you have a question, please line up behind the microphones. We will not be taking questions from the seats. And while you're lining up and thinking of your question, I have an ask of each of our four fabulous entrepreneurs/intrapreneurs on stage. Rather than asking you to give more advice to the audience, I would like each of you to issue a marching order. Mm. And that sounds militant, but what it can sound like is, my wish for all of you is what? Sarah, why don't we mix it up and start at your end?
Sure. My wish for all of you is to just do it. Because I think women, this is true of myself too, we have a tendency to over-prepare, to find everything in the optimal situation before we take that first step, and to know that you are ready, you are more than ready.
Yeah.
My wish for everyone here is that every time you get a no, it's a new beginning, because that's just going to lead you to the next one. And one of the girls that work for me say, like, it's just a game of numbers. The more shots you take, you'll eventually get one.
Yeah.
So just take all the shots and have a really tough stomach.
So my wish would be that we take more time to celebrate wins. Take a moment, really celebrate it. Don't just do what you do every day. Go home, make dinner, go to bed, repeat. Like, do something special for yourself.
I love that. And my wish for you is that you find your value and then own that. Own it, own it, own it. Just like an education, no one can ever take it from you. That's my wish for you.
I don't see anyone with a question.
Oh, wait. We've
got a here we go. They didn't want to miss these marching orders.
They were just burning with it on the inside.
Yes. Let's start here on the right-hand side, my right-hand side, your left.
Hello. Oh, okay. Thank you. This has been amazing.
Please speak right into the microphone.
I'll speak right into it. So the question that I have is about vision. I saw that was one of the subtitles of this. And something I struggle with is I don't know exactly envision like a certain position I want to have or like exactly where I want to go. But I really like the idea of taking more ownership of my career. So how do you navigate that, or how do you find the vision that you're trying to obtain?
Anyone? Who wants to go first?
I feel like this was like the theme of my 20s, and I really, really relate to this. I had like an Excel spreadsheet with like 10 different scenarios of all the different career paths I could possibly follow. And it's agonizing, isn't it? I feel like it's an existential crisis of sorts. I think the thing that actually really helped me most was reading. And reading autobiographies and books, and it was a very like introspective process rather than an extroverted one. I think a lot of people will say like, go have coffee with a lot of people, go hear about what their jobs are like, you know, go see if you could follow somebody at their job, which I think is all good advice. But I think the part that I neglected to do initially was just like the internal reflection, which I think comes from putting your phone away, putting social media away, like actually reading books, like philosophers, like really old time philosophers. This is going to sound crazy, but like Schopenhauer, I think, is a really good one, because people have struggled with this very question, this existential question, for centuries. Like, this is not just a problem of our decade; it's a human problem. And so, I think actually turning to some of those old scholars actually did really pave a path for me and help me think about how I make the most meaning out of my life. And so, I just highly I recommend that the kind of introspective process.
Yeah, and I'd say too, figure out like, what do you want your life to feel like? Everyone always looks at, what do I want it to look like? That's cool and all, because I too had, you know, the Excel spreadsheet figuring it out. But what do you want it to feel like? I knew for me, I want it to feel free, and I want it to be able to be the best mom and then also legacy leaver that I could, which meant helping women. So that's what I wanted it to feel like. So then I just built up around what I wanted that feeling to be.
Thank you. We have lines of women at the microphones now, so we're going to move quickly, and I'm going to come over to this side of the room.
Sure. First of all, thank you for sharing your experience and your thoughts and your wishes. You just did. This is really great. My question is specific to Sarah. You mentioned that your friends, when you started, you know, with the dresses, they said, oh, she's just doing the dresses. I've heard that a couple of times myself. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is, did it affect you? And if it did, how did you overcome that?
I'm sorry, can you say the first part of your question?
Did it affect you?
Oh, did it affect me?
Yeah.
Yes.
And of course it affects. And how did you overcome that feeling?
It affected me greatly, and I don't know if I ever overcame it, which is, you know, it's the truth.
I feel the same,
Totally. I describe entrepreneurship as like, it's like you're setting off for this island in the distance, and you push off and you start swimming, and every now and then you look up and the current's pushed you away, and you're like not even sure if that's the island you meant to swim to anymore. And it would be so much easier if you just swam back, as you can still see the sandy beach on the other side. It's grueling. This is why like most people do not do entrepreneurship, and I think it is to know that you are very much not alone in feeling that way. And I think that's why actually the people who I became closest to and who were most supportive in my process were other entrepreneurs. My college roommates, I love them dearly. They could not understand what I was going through. Same for my husband, like who I, you know, say everything to, but he had a corporate job. It's totally different.
It's different.
Yeah, find other entrepreneurs in your network and they will 120% relate.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Over here.
So I recently took my shot. I found the person that, you know, shared the same dream and vision as I did. I damn near pulled him off the stage at an event he was the keynote of. And had my meeting, he said yes. However, I got maybe a bigger promotion than I bargained for. So my question is I'm over here riddled with anxiety. I've got probably the worst case of imposter syndrome that I've ever come across. Have you experienced that? How have you overcome that? I feel like I've like pulled one over on everyone. You know, I didn't finish college. You know, what am I doing? How did I get here?
This sounds ridiculous, but I would take it day by day. Like, what for me personally, what I do is I know there's a laundry list of 50 things that I need to do, and it's going to take me forever and probably longer than normal. But if I can start organizing my thoughts and say, if I can accomplish this tomorrow and this the next day and this the next day, it, funny enough, starts building confidence in yourself that you're chipping away at what you're trying to do. Because the reality is you're never going to finish it in a day, and you're not going to finish, you're not going to feel better in 2 days. So how do you get those small wins to get to the North Star that you're working towards?
Thank you. Ladies, this is going to be our last question, so we can all stay on time. I'm sure those of you with questions are going to be able to connect and ask them afterwards, but we'll end with a question over here. No pressure.
I know, right? Make it good. So hi again. Thank you. My name is Patty Kumar. I work as an engineer. I've recently graduated, just started 4 months into work.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. But I did a lot of work as with entrepreneuring and then working with other entrepreneurs, and I've gotten caught in a space where now I've gotten really excited about this one idea and I've started working on it, and maybe Courtney, this is for you, and I've now become an expert and everyone's starting to ask me questions, but I have tons of other things I'd kind of want to start doing. And so I'm doing this job, this is my dream job, and I came into this space with all my fresh ideas, but I have other ideas that I personally also want to work on. But when you're thinking about my personal time in my mind, you know, I don't think I can handle it. So when you're thinking about pivoting, like, what are those questions that I should ask myself of, I'm a value add to this space, like, but I want to go do this new thing. Like, how do you make that decision?
Are the other things adjacent to what you're doing now, or
no,
is it a completely different thing?
Okay. No, they're completely different.
Completely different thing. Okay. And the question is, how do you decide, like, personally to make that shift?
Yeah, like, what are those key questions that I should be considering?
Do you keep going to bed at night thinking about this new idea, this new opportunity?
Yeah, well, yeah.
So then what's holding you back from doing it?
Whole money, you know? Gotta go to work.
I would say, like, I have an orientation to just jump and go for it. I think if it's always on my mind, if it gets me really excited, it eliminates Sunday scaries and all of that crazy, like, you gotta just go for it. And know that it's not gonna be perfect right away, but sometimes the other great thing to do is sort of assess what are the risks. So write down all the risks, write down all the rewards, and then compare them. But I have an orientation to just go for it.
You can also ask yourself, like, what's the best use of your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, I love that.
Whatever that answer is, you should do. Yep. There's only one life, so.
Such a simple.
Thank you.
Thank you all for attending. I want to let you know two things before we go. The first one is Alicia is going to be signing her book, Eating Elephants, in the exhibit hall area at 12:30. And thank you for writing that book. Thank you so much for teaching us about eating elephants. I also want to say that tomorrow is Female Founders Day. And if you haven't talked to a female founder in a while, you just heard from these women what it takes in terms of guts and courage and resiliency. So I ask you tomorrow, when you meet a female founder, high five her for what she's doing for all of us in the world. And with that, we can end our session.
Nice.
Thank you.
That was great.